everybody, and welcome to 2ZQ Hot Takes, where we discuss issues both big and small. I am your host, the very handsome Tim Kirk, and this time I'll be reading from my semi-autobiographical novel, I'm Just Making It Up As I Go Along, and Things Have Not Been Working Out As Well As I Intended, Chapter 9813, My Bravest Moment in Life. My bravest moment in life was something I could never share or talk about openly while in their presence. They would never comprehend the impact or the enormity of what I did to save the lives of innocent people who would otherwise have been gunned down by insane, heavily armed, drug-crazed, money-hungry coke dealers. Which was a bit on the personally frustrating side of things, but I knew my efforts would never ever be appreciated, even if they were made aware, because they just didn't care. Everything awful that happened to other people was mere entertainment to them. So, one afternoon, several, and I mean at least 2 months, after the titular chef drug magnate died, I was working the day shift with all of the other unsuspecting staff and one of the women who had taken a few shifts a week, mostly to get out of the house and make a few extra bucks for herself, that kind of thing. A very nice, upright, decent married girl, culturally literate with a vocabulary which implied that she was familiar with abstract concepts. Huh, go figure. Noticed something and said out of bewilderment, "What's that?" And I and a few other people working all walked over to the tinted plate glass window in the front of the restaurant and saw what I referred to myself and myself only as the evil A-team. It was a van. It was sitting in the parking lot with the engine running. The side door had been opened all the way. Inside, there was a machine gun on a turret tripod mount thing pointed at the restaurant. There was a crazy, and I mean crazy, looking dude wearing two bandoleros with ammunition and what I assumed were Uzis. This was 1987. He looked like a caricature of a 70s movies villain, with a crazed look on his face. There was another guy with them. I think they were actually wearing berets, too. The driver of the van and the guy sitting in the passenger seat were also similarly equipped with bandoleros full of ammunition and Uzis. I said to myself, shit. Either I die or all of these innocent people die. They had enough firepower to shoot the entire building in half horizontally. No cap, as the kiddies say. They were ready to kill. Absolutely nobody inside the place had any idea who they were, what they were doing there, what they wanted, that there was any issue whatsoever. They had zero curiosity as to the situation. Most of them were dealing with grief, and there was also a complete other horrible incident which had recently occurred on site, which was a terrible, life-threatening, excruciatingly painful incident everybody was dealing with in the aftermath of the death. Barely time to grieve, the staff, who were the spine of the place, were devastated and just rocked back on their heels, but carrying on, because that was how they made their livings. Although it was not a fun atmosphere, and the people who exploited the most out of the vulnerabilities of the situation for their own gratification took no responsibility to keep any sense of continuity going whatsoever. None. It was less than a free-for-all, more like a scavenger picking through rubble for valuables at the bottom of a building collapse, when they were fully aware that the people who those valuables belonged to were still around, but they knew that they could sneak whatever they found out without being detected, because the people were so distracted. One partner just mentally checked out, so he was almost never around, except to take food in bed with him on his way out to go for a ride on his boat. But his involvement in running the place had been usurped because he had a decidedly lowbrow approach and was profoundly small-minded and cheap in his thinking, approach, and execution. At the beginning of the renovation process of the restaurant, which had occurred about 2 years prior, we needed to remove a ratty old cupboard that would now be called shabby chic or farmhouse chic or some other drivel for ratty crap that is supposed to be authentic and reminiscent of an antique from a poignant historical era, for a while anyway. It was just an old piece of crap that we mostly stored games on during the time the place was more easy breezy and had a much lighter menu when it was a hangout instead of a fledgling real restaurant. As we were lugging it out of the building, he emphatically stated that we were making a big mistake, something that wasn't even worth the wood it was made out of. He also lacked the gift of gab, which was necessary in dealing with strangers. He was courting workers on loading docks while the rest of us were doing our best to impress professionals with cash, who wanted more from a dinner than shrimp cocktail, French onion soup, salad with blue cheese dressing, and steak well done, while everybody in the moneyed places were eating salmon with dill sauce and something with sun-dried tomatoes, 1987. While he was doing his best to appease barbarians using utensils like cavemen. Nothing against them, but this was not suited to them. Our inventory would go to waste if we catered to their tastes instead of attracting people who would shell out more for more expensive offerings, and what the rest of us were trying to accomplish was not only naive and mostly uninformed, but much lower brow than we believed we were doing. We thought we were doing something better. In reality, we were just a notch above pub grub. And there were other people there, new to the situation, and some were good, some were not so good, but it was a huge gaping hole where there had been a thriving subculture and a promising, evolving business going on. I contrast this to the world of work and workplace culture where everybody is a good little doobie, and they all have plastered-on smiles on their cherubic faces as they scurry from meeting to meeting and always have a kumbaya solution to every problem, real or imagined, and there are no problems, only solutions, and we are all in this together except for when we are not, and the few of us chosen to get preferential treatment take company-paid expense trips to conferences and learn how to motivate others to engage and dignify everyone except when we are cutting the lesser preferred ones off and having our own closed-door receptions and ignore the shit out of you and drop names of people you wouldn't want to know on a bet. The people who look past you, through you, around you, above you, below you, to the side of you, but never directly acknowledge you or look you in the eye. They don't just snub you. They purposefully use their snubbing as a pedestal to climb up on the next rung of the social professional ladder. But they talk about DEI for a living. Powerhouse leaders of industry, NGO government liaisons, executives forging new pathways to inclusion and equity, leaders with vision for the future. Now, could you please get out of the way? We are taking a group picture and attending a private cocktail hour with the CEO of this diversity-focused org. They love to get high, but can't possibly acknowledge the lowlifes selling them their party favors. They look to the new arrivals, the young, dedicated, committed professionals who are here to make a difference, and they invite them to their hotel suites with fully stocked bars for drinks and conversation. Oh, yes, they do. But they get lost in fugue states, too, and they need to continue leading their double lives. They just switch closets. This is what happens when you get positive reinforcement at specific times in your life. I have been so beaten down that any weak attempt at it aimed at me is met with instinctive, immediate suspicion, like I am walking into a trap. It's either an insulting, patronizing letdown or a feckless attempt at manipulation. But I have been around people who have received so much positive reinforcement that they cannot distinguish actual harsh criticism from praise, because they look for a win in every scenario or situation, no matter how awful their performance or results. They just cannot process anything but positive feedback, and think the plain truth actually means the opposite of what they have been told to their faces. They are also the same people who were ageist, weightist, and any other ist except overt racist, because they know they have to be mindful of the precious gem in their crowns. They wear that and fall all over any perceived slight or insult to someone's racial identity as if they are falling on a sword for them. They don't really give a damn. And sexuality to a lesser extent, because you can actually see the marbles roll around the inside of their heads when they have to deal with the DEI issue involving a member of the LGBTQIA+ community and are desperately looking for an out to extricate themselves from a situation they are uncomfortable in or are trying to find a way to condemn the gay person because they themselves are biased and want to be able to express it to lord over them, but in a subtly nuanced manner and use euphemisms about conduct or inappropriateness or something they just attach to anyone else's inherent identity to exert control over them. The excuses for excluding you as a queer enter and you just don't fit. It isn't a match, blah, 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 etc. I have given a prezo to the same room full of people when I was 15 to 20 pounds overweight and flatly rejected. I gave the exact same materials to someone 20 years younger and in better shape, and they gave the exact same prezo to a wildly receptive group who praised them for his authentic, original, brilliant ideas. I held and hold them in contempt. One guy I worked with, a smart, sharp guy who walked away and went into his own enterprise, had to pitch his business to some of the same people and their peers, and I ran into him in the concourse lobby of the massive building we were in. We caught up, chatted, and he expressed his frustration, saying that it was all bullshit and that he knows how I hate the bullshit. He was correct. It was funny because he was shoulder to shoulder with very many of them and never embraced the bullshit. But he knew I had no use for it. I liked that guy. So back to the restaurant. I breathed deeply and walked out. The parking lot was gravel, so each step was distinctly memorable. I walked up to about 10 feet from the open door of the van, and the guy behind the machine gun had an itchy trigger finger, like he was just waiting for the go-ahead from the driver, also reminded me of one of the henchmen who killed Murphy in RoboCop, but with crazy hair. Sort of like one of the guys in Scarface, but dressed as Che Guevara. And he was wearing fatigues. How stereotypical could this surreal situation be? I thought to myself as I was about to sacrifice myself for the safety of the others. The driver also happened to be the drug dealer from the insane scene of buying the drugs. He knew me. He was well aware of me. He knew my name. I was never, ever introduced to him. My friend owed him over $40,000 in 1987. That's when it hit me. Holy shit. I really had been doing insanely expensive, insanely huge amounts of rockstar cocaine. Yeep. Like there was a sane amount of cocaine. It's just like the term overdose on smack. Oh, is there an appropriate illegal dosage of deadly heroin we have been unaware of? Anyway, my heart was pounding. I was doing my best to be cool and calm. It was very much like a Sergio Leone movie. The gravel under my feet crunching away, my slow, dead-eyed, determined stride, stopping 10 feet away from the open door to the evil A-team's van. I said, "Ken's dead, Oscar. He's been dead since June. He died on June 7th. He overdosed." Suddenly, the drug dealer's right eyebrow arched up. He looked me dead in the eye. I said, "If you don't believe me, you can go visit his grave. He is buried in Woodlawn or Forest Lawn or whatever," I said, but I had the correct cemetery. He stared me down for what seemed like an hour. I knew I was about to be shot dead. After what seemed like an eternity, he pulled the van out of neutral into reverse with the brakes on, kept his eyes peeled on me, and said, "If he isn't dead, I'll come back and kill you." I knew he was telling the truth. He signaled to the bloodlusted, terribly disappointed henchman to close the door, which he did. He then pulled back and drove out. I never saw him again. I walked back into the restaurant, closed the door behind me, and leaned as heavy as I could against the closed door of the restaurant, which had a stained glass window, almost as if I was leaning hard against it to keep it closed and anyone from entering. I was clearly visible from and could easily still have been picked off and shot in the back as they drove away if they really wanted to punish me. I looked down, collected myself, said holy fucking shit about 10,000 times to myself in 3 seconds, and looked up. "What was that?" asked the girls. "Nothing," I said. I went into the men's room and stared in the mirror. I had to wipe the look of shock off of my face. It took a few minutes. I slapped myself a few times, straightened myself out, and pretended everything was fine. I seemed, to the others, to have taken the entire experience in stride as uneventful, and nobody was any the wiser. It went on unremarked upon. Holy shit! That was the bravest thing I ever did. I never said a word to anybody until now. They used to tease me for being sensitive. It was something to mock and humiliate anyone for. Sensitivity. An exposed, perceived vulnerability. Oh, instead of gliding over that and occasionally reminding people that it wasn't good form to fixate on foibles, they instead focused their emotional energies on others' perceived sensitivities and never let go. Like a bulldog grabbing the ring on a bull. I am pretty sure the goal was reducing the sensitive one to tears to ruin their self-esteem or make them emotional basket cases, until it came time for someone else to zero in on their sensitivities, and then they attack relentlessly and create an air of hostile repellence, with all the tact and aplomb of the ambassador to the world. What really weirded me out was that this was 1987, and owing over $40,000 to a drug-crazed homicidal coke dealer did not cause him to collect any of his money for well over 2 months. I mean, you have to be in some way out cloud of coke to be so disconnected until you realize that the white kid owes you over $40,000 in cash. In 1987 cash. At the same time, the entire restaurant was just coming over the mourning period from my friend, and at the same time, several other employees were spiraling down in their own addiction holes. At the very same time, the restaurant also had a revolving door of hack chefs and shoemaker cooks, so the quality suffered, and spirits were and had been low for a few months. The atmosphere did not help the addiction spirals. Loads were far from being lightened, and every day brought a new melodramatic variable to the environment. Every new variable was completely insane. Off the hook, as they say. Anarchically uncivilized and so much vision-free, nihilistic, self-centered selfishness. That is another story. All I can say is that I was glad I had gone on the wagon about 5 months earlier and was staying on it for the foreseeable term. I might be dumb, but it wasn't that dumb. Anyway, I'm going to stop right there because I got another part coming up. Thanks for listening. See you next time. And as the kiddies say, peace out.